Hi, my name is Bob Lemke, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. And just so you get things straight, I'm a member of the world-famous Easy Does It group in Glendale, California, the best group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't believe that your home group is the best group in Alcoholics Anonymous, you better find another home group. And I'm glad to be here, alive, well, and sober. For without you people, I wouldn't be here. And before I get started, for the five newcomers who had the courage to stand up in a group like this and say they're new, you know, I'd have never done it. And for all those guys that I see back there who are looking at me at the corner of their eye and all that jazz, and I think it's got something to do with this haircut, I want to clear something up right off the start so we won't hear any more about that. I want you to realize that I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous with a haircut like this. When I got here, I had one of them flat-top butch haircuts, you know, you get in the service. And I used to pride myself in how even and how flat one could keep it, a big deal, you know. And I think I was sober 7 or 8 years, and my kids called me in the family room one night. They said, "Dad, we want to talk to you." And I thought, "My God, what do they want now?" And he said, "You've been sober a long time now, and we think you ought to clean up your act." And I said, "Just what are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, we think you ought to start doing the things that modern people do." And I said, "Yeah, what's that?" And he said, "We think you ought to let your hair grow." And I believed him. And I don't know about any of you guys, but if you ever had one of them butch haircuts, and you let it grow out, it starts to look like hell. And mine grew out high and low. And just about the time it was sticking out like a wild man, I got a call to go and speak at the convention in Arizona. And in typical alcoholic, frantic sobriety, I went running around, "What am I going to do about this damn hair?" And so I went down to Hollywood, to one of those places. Not what you're thinking about, honey. And this gal started working on my hair and convinced me that this is the way I'm supposed to wear my hair. My hair. And I believed her. And then I got on a plane and got down to Phoenix. And it was my first time speaking out of state. And I don't know about any of you guys, but the first time you get asked to speak out of state, it's kind of a big deal. And I'm the kind of nut that can make a big, big deal out of a little deal. And I got up there, and I'm the kind of drunk that I got to say something cute about everything new in my life anyhow. And so I got up to the podium, and I said, "You know anybody?" And this hairdo was really bugging me, because I wasn't really convinced about it, you know. And so I got up to the podium and I said, "You know anybody walking around with a haircut like this? There's got to be something wrong with them." And everybody kind of snickered except one gal. She was sitting right on the aisle where this girl is with the white coat on. And she damn near rolled off the chair laughing. And I thought she was laughing at me instead of with us. And I said, "Honey, don't laugh. It just cost me $8.50. And she leaned over to the gal sitting next to her, and just when it was quiet in the room, the whole auditorium heard it. She said, "He got screwed." But be that as it may, we didn't come here to talk about hairdos, at least I didn't. But since we got such a nice mixed audience here tonight, there's this story I love to tell. And to me, it epitomizes Alcoholics Anonymous, you and I, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has to do with that kind of thinking. And it's about this guy who had this obsession to go and get a suntan, you know. You and I are the kind of people who get obsessions. We get obsessions about ice cream, you know. We get obsessions about drinking Coca-Cola. We get obsessions about eating candy bars. And this guy had an obsession to get a suntan. And he was one of those guys who went to the beach every day just to get a suntan. And you know and I know that if you go to the beach every day to get a suntan, the sun's going to do the job. Eventually, you're going to be brown. And pretty soon, this guy was as brown as the top rail around here, you know. And that's why I'm certain he's alcoholic, because he wasn't satisfied, you know. And that's your nature and my nature, never satisfied with nothing. and he kept going back for more. Just like you and I, always going back for more, you know. There's one thing always goes through the mind of most alcoholics, and it's one word, and it's more, more. And this guy went back to get more. And he got down to the beach that morning, and there wasn't a soul on the beach, not a living soul. He is the only guy there. And he got to thinking, and that's where I'm certain he's alcoholic. Because when you and I get to thinking, we're in trouble. Most of us, when we get to thinking, we're in trouble. And this guy got to thinking like this. He thought, if only that part where his suit is, if that would be as brown as the rest of his body, then it would be perfect. And that's what you and I strive for, perfection. And he looked up and down the beach and there isn't a soul. And he just thought to himself, by God, I'm going to do it. And he took her off. And as soon as he had it off, he realized his predicament, that the sun wasn't going to even it out. But with that quick alcoholic mind, that fast, he figured if he laid down on the sand and took sand and covered up everything that was already brown, then the sun would get at, you understand? And he's laying there kind of dozing off, you know? She understands. And his two little old grandmas come along the beach for their morning constitutional, and you know how they are, holding on to each other's arm and helping each other through the sand. And all of a sudden they came across it. And they both spotted it at the same time. And they stopped dead in their tracks. And the first one says, oh, Martha, it's terrible. And Martha gave it a quick shot, and she said to her friend, you know, there's just no justice left in the world anymore. And her friend looked at her in utter bewilderment and says, what do you mean by that? And she says, well, I'll tell you. When I was 16, I didn't know what it was. When I was 25, I tried it. When I was 45, I couldn't get enough of it. When I was 60, I had to buy it. And she says, now I'm 82 and it's growing wild. And we didn't come here to talk about that. But I dearly love to tell it. Because, in my opinion, it brings out the one ingredient that's the medicine in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's in the book. It's the laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous that's the medicine here. For without it, you and I would surely die. The laughter. Because I'm certain today, and I'm certain about all the people I know in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I would have walked in here, and you would have been all sitting here with long faces and saying, here we got to stay the rest of our lives, I'd have split, you know. I don't know about you, but the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, there were no funnies going on at our house. I mean, she wasn't sitting around telling funny stories and crap like that. It was just the opposite. It was a lot of that cold Al-Anon stares. And a lot of that dead silence. And a lot of crying. And all that crap. And so I'm eternally grateful for the laughter that takes place here. And those five new people that stood up here and said that they're new tonight. They aren't going to understand this. But I'm hoping that someday they will. That they really are the most important people in this room tonight. For without them, Alcoholics Anonymous, as I understand it, would surely die. Because we'd have all us old-timers standing around here telling us each other these same old stories, and we'd all get drunk, you know. And they don't understand about this laughter, because, you know, they walk into a meeting and some guy's up there talking about going down the road and hitting five parked cars and two squad cars and a couple trees. And everybody who's been around a while kind of snickers. And the newcomer sits there in utter bewilderment and says, what the hell's so funny about that? It just happened to me. And it's true. When it's happening to you, it's not funny. I mean, it's tragedy time. And don't they understand? And that's one thing we do here. We understand. Because there isn't anything in this world that we haven't done. We've done it all. Because we're the kind of people, if it's worth doing at all, it's worth doing to excess. Anything! That's our nature. And so I'm eternally grateful for the laughter that takes place in these rooms. Because I can remember walking into my first meeting and everything's chaos and Jesus, you know, the tragedy and my God, you know, they're going to repo the car tomorrow and rent's overdue. Jesus, thank God she wasn't overdue. And then this laughter took place. And for the first time in my life, something happened and I started to laugh, you know, not them little tee-hees, you know, that you did in the bars, but that way down here, it comes uncontrollable and it comes spontaneously. And all of a sudden I'm laughing, I thought, what the hell am I laughing at, you know? And then all of a sudden I realized that, by God, that happened to me. And I should be dead. And you should be dead. And we all shouldn't be here. And so we're all sitting in rooms full of miracles. Because each and every one of us has our own story. And what happened to you might be a little bit different than what happened to me. But we all ended up in the same kettle of fish, drunk, and not wanting to be drunk. And pitiful, and incomprehensible, and didn't want to have to do all those things. And so, I'm eternally grateful for the things that go on in meetings like this, in rooms like this, all over this country. And I guess I'm twice blessed because I've had the privilege to do a lot of sharing in meetings across this country, and I'm eternally grateful. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on the 13th of January, 1964, life as I understood life was over with, and I couldn't make it. And I'm thoroughly convinced today that had I not gone to the lengths I had to go, I probably had never made it. And so whatever it took you to get here, I believe that's what it took. And granted, a lot of it is not pretty, and we're not proud of it, but I believe it was all necessary. Because I came that close to dying, and I'd never planned to die at 31 years old, you know, or 34. I'm even forgetting how old I am now. And it doesn't mean anything anymore. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, we didn't have a lot of speaker meetings. We had a lot of discussion groups. And they sat around long tables and they talked about all kinds of weird crap, you know. At least I thought it was, you know. And they talked about things they did drunk. And I thought, by God, if I have to tell these people about all the things I did drunk, they'll kick me out of here too. Because I just been 86th out of some of them padded sewers down in Skid Row for bad language. And I thought, oh, God, here's another one of those deals. And I've got to, you know, confess all this crap. And they sat around those tables and at that time and still today, they seem to take great delight in putting the finger on newcomers, you know. And he put the finger on me because I was the newest guy in the room that night. And he kept putting the finger on me and saying stupid things like, what did you do today to stay sober, Sonny? Sonny! You know, that just drove me up a tree. I mean, there were people in that room that had gray hair, and I figured, by God, if I ever got that old, I'd quit too, you know. But I was 34 years old, hip, slick, and cool, you know. And he kept putting the finger on me and asking me all them stupid questions, and finally I said to this guy sitting next to me, if they don't stop it, I'm going to hit him in the mouth. And then finally I went back to that group, and I don't know why I went back, because it's not my nature and it's not your nature to go back to something you don't like or that's distasteful or something that put you on a spot and made you feel awkward. And I went back to that group, I guess, just to see if they'd cleaned up their act or were going to start to treat me in a manner in which I'd love to become accustomed or something. And I walked into the meeting that night. And there was a guy standing near the door, and he had a tie on, and I figured he's the big kahuna around there. And I went up to him, and I said, are we going to sit around those tables again tonight and talk about what we did today to stay sober? And he said, nope, tonight we got a big treat. And I said, yeah, what's that big deal? And he says, we've got a speaker, and he's coming all the way from Venice. And I thought it was Italy. And I said, yeah, what's his name? And he said, Serenity Sam. And for those of you from Northern California who don't know about Sam, especially at that time, he was a very vocal member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he used a lot of four-letter words from podiums. And there were a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who didn't like four-letter words coming from podiums. And I thought they were all a bunch of squares. And I've come to find out that they were right and I was wrong again. Because I believe today that it isn't necessary to use all that profanity and barroom talk coming from Alcoholics Anonymous podiums. I'm thoroughly convinced today that if we don't grow in Alcoholics Anonymous, we might as well return from whence we came, back to the barroom. And we don't have to have barroom talk in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. But I thought at the time they were all a bunch of squares. There's one after me right now. Being disagreeable is not being disagreeable. But at the time, this guy who was telling me about Sam said, he's quite a guy. And he helped a lot of guys get to Alcoholics Anonymous. He helped a lot of guys stay sober. And he said, he's really quite a guy. He says, in fact, he started a group down in Venice and they called it Where the Debris Meets the Sea. And I thought, how apropos, you know. Because I don't know about you, but when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and I looked that herd over, I thought, by God, I wouldn't have drank with half of them. And he went on to explain about Sam. And I wasn't listening too well. And then all of a sudden, I got to thinking. And I'm sure there's newcomers sitting here tonight are doing the same kind of thinking, you know. I thought, you know, a smart cookie like me have to sit around here and listen to some jerk from Venice? I think I'll split. And just about the time I made that decision, the door opened up and this guy stepped in the room. And this guy had been talking to me, the guy with the tie, hit me in the ribs like that. And he said, there he is. And I said, there's who? He says, weren't you listening? I said, no. He says, that's Sam. And I looked at that guy and I thought, by God, he even looks like a drunk. And I think I'll stick around and see what this jerk's got to say. And thank God I did. Because that night, whether I believed it or recognized it, or even believed it a long time after. And I'm sure Sam didn't realize it, that he was performing a miracle that night. But that night a little miracle took place in my life. Because up until that night, in my entire life, I don't believe no human being. Especially that walking around kind. Because they all had to be phonies, cheats, and liars like me. And I don't believe no humans. And then for some unbeknownst reason, this guy who I had never seen before in my life, didn't know from Adam, got up here and started to share the only thing we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. We only got one thing here, and it's in the book. It's the sharing of experience, strength, and hope. You know, I know there's a lot of people today coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for all kinds of weird ideas. And they're coming here to get their wives back, and get their husbands back, and get the job back, and get the kids back, and get some long green, and new wheels and a new pad and all that crap. But the only thing we have here when it comes down to the bottom line is the sharing of experience, strength, and hope. And if it fits, grab a hold of it. It might save your life. And Sam started to share this experience, strength, and hope. And that the only thing that hit me then that I can remember is I looked at it and I heard him talk and I thought, by God, there's another one just like me. And if there's anybody new here tonight, and that thought comes to your mind, and I thought, you know, if a silly-looking jerk like that can make it, a smart cookie like me can surely make it. And I'm sure there's somebody sitting here tonight that's in anybody with a haircut like that. And they can make it. By God, smart guy like me can surely make it. And that's a start. And that's a start, so there's nothing wrong with that kind of thinking. Because it's positive-type thinking. And he went on to share some of this experience, strength, and hope. And he said he had a brother who was a drunk. And I thought, oh, that's no big deal. So do I. And then he said, he never drank with his brother. And I said, that's no big deal, neither have I. And then he said, he was home one Saturday doing the things that them women conjure up on Friday. It's called the honeydew list. It's honeydew this and honeydew that, you know. And he was home doing the lawn. He got halfway through the lawn, he got thirsty. That made sense to me. I was always thirsty. And he said he headed down to the corner saloon just to get a couple tall, cool ones and cool off them hot pipes from that hard manual labor. Made sense to me. And he met his brother. And he got home 11 days later. And that made sense to me. Just happened to me. And when he met his brother, he said they did one of the smartest things I'd ever heard anybody talk about around those tables. He said they took up residence in Sam's car. Sam in the front seat and his brother in the back. I thought, there's another smart drunk just like me. You know, you don't spend that money on hotels and motels and all that crap. You save that money for drinking whiskey. And if there's any car sleepers here tonight, I want to talk to you after the meeting. Because that's where I come from. And it's amazing that Sam's drunk lasted 11 days. Because since I've been sober, I've had the privilege to do a little studying about alcoholism. And medical science tells you and I that you and I as alcoholics can ingest alcohol alcoholically for 11 consecutive days. And that's it, brother. 11 consecutive days. And then the way the human body is designed, it will expel this foreign substance, alcohol, from it, from every opening there is in the body. And you can't believe how many openings there are in the body. And you can imagine what Sam's car looked like at the end of 11 days. Like mine looked like at the end of 18. And you know, it's amazing. I want to talk about those car sleepers just a second. Because you know, today in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're getting so big and so diverse, and we're getting so many people from all walks of life and educational backgrounds and religious training and everything. And we're getting all over this, not only in California, but all over this country. We're getting to have people talk, especially in general service meetings where they want to segregate Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I'm sure you heard it here. They want to have special meetings for all the doctors and attorneys in AA. And they want to have special meetings for all the judges in AA. And they want to have special meetings for all the priests and the clergy in AA. And they want to have special meetings for all the blacks in AA, and the Chicanos in AA, and the gays in AA. And I think it's all a bunch of crap. Because there isn't one thing in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about segregation. Thank God. But I believe if there's ever to be any segregation, it should be the car sleepers in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we have one thing in common that all the other drunks in AA don't have. We all have tricks in our necks here. Comes from prolonged usage of armrests for pillows. And the doctor says it's never going to go away. And on these cold, damp nights, wherever I go, halfway through my talk, I can look out in the audience and spot them car sleepers. Because they're all doing the same thing. They're all rubbing them necks, you know. And everybody who's done any time in a car knows the one thing that happens to all car sleeping drunks on that eventful morning that you come to in a car. You have to reach down inside and get the last ounce of courage just to poke your head up over the dash to figure out where the hell you are. Because we move around a lot, you know. And Sam said that he came to first that morning. And with all the courage he could muster, he poked his head up over the dash just trying to find a familiar tree or a sign or something to zero in just where they were. And he said it took him about 10 minutes. And all of a sudden he figured it out. They were parked in the middle of the city of Santa Monica City dump. And I thought, my God, why didn't I think of that? Because the cops don't look for you too often in the city dump. And the cops had been looking for me because I hung a lot of bad paper out there, too. And if there's any paper hangers here tonight, I want to talk to you after the meeting. And just about the time Sam had it figured out where in the heck they were, his little brother came too in the back seat. And with all the courage he could muster, he poked his head up over the back seat and looked to his big brother Sam to the answer to the big question. Where the hell are we, Sam? And Sam had just figured it out, right? And he said the most profound thing I've ever heard up until that night in Alcoholics Anonymous. He turned to his little brother and said, "They've thrown us away." And I knew right then and there I was in the right outfit. I didn't get here by mistake. And if you got that feeling from that little thing about Sam, you're in the right place, and don't sweat it anymore. You're home scot-free. And that made me feel a part of. It made me feel that I belonged here. Like I could take off my shoes and wiggle my toes and say, "My God, I made it, you know. I'm home scot-free. I'm with people who understand me." And that's what this whole thing is all about. It has to do with our attitudes towards people, places, and things. And it's in the book. It's in the book. Because that's the only thing we can change in our entire life, is our attitude towards people, places, and things. And most of us, including myself, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had people, places, and things all screwed up with money, property, and prestige. And I thought the world runs on money, property, and prestige. And I'm here tonight to tell you, I've had it all taken away, and I've had it all restored, and it doesn't mean a hill of beans. Doesn't mean a hill of beans. Because according to these principles, I've come to find out one of the greatest truths of life, through these principles, that if it isn't right here, it's never going to be right, no matter what it is. No matter what it is, if it isn't right here, it's never going to be right. And through you people, I've been able to, most of the time, put things in the right perspective, and then it's no big deal anymore. Because you and I are the kind of people, one of the biggest problems we have is we got a built-in magnifier up here, and we can make big deals out of little deals that fast. All we have to do is think about it for 5 minutes, and we can make a big deal out of nothing. Just let us think about it for 5 minutes. And then all of a sudden, I don't know about you, but this one word comes in my head, kill. And if I recognize that in myself, then life doesn't become such a mess. And it isn't easy. Nothing about this is easy. And I want to say a few words to the newcomers tonight, because like I said, you're the most important people here tonight. And unfortunately, and I don't intend to preach, but I've been around long enough to see that you and I, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, aren't doing too good a job as far as newcomers are concerned. We're killing a lot of newcomers. You know, I hear them telling all this crap that they tell newcomers. And they don't only tell it in California, but they do it in the East Coast and in the Midwest. They tell them 75% of the people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous make it. That is not the truth, newcomer. The truth is that 90% of the people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous don't make it. And the reason they don't make it is because they refuse to do it. They absolutely refuse to do it. They say, "I'm different and I'm unique and I don't have to do it like those idiots." And they die drunk. They die drunk. And so we have a lot of work to do. And I hear people telling newcomers all kinds of weird things. They tell them, "This is an easy program and you can do it any damn way you want to." And that's a tip-off. So newcomer, if you hear anybody tell you anything like that, get as far away from that ding-a-ling as you can get. Because the only reason they're telling you this is an easy program because they haven't done it themselves. The only reason they're telling you that is because they haven't done it themselves. Because there is nothing easy about this. The only thing we're going to ask you to do is change your entire way of living. And if that's easy for you, it was not easy for me. It was the toughest deal I've ever had in my life. But I've come to find out that anything in life that's worth a damn doesn't come easy. And that's where that old phraseology that's been handed down for centuries comes from. A lot of these old slogans that are handed down for centuries, there is no free lunch. And that's where it comes from. Anything in life that's worth a damn doesn't come easy. Nothing. And I've had to work for my sobriety, and everybody I know who's been sober any length of time will tell you they had to work for their sobriety. And I'm eternally grateful for the efforts I had to make just to stay sober, because it was another growing experience, and you and I have to grow or we will surely die. And so I'm eternally grateful. And if they tell you that you can do it any damn way you want to, that's an absolute tip-off, because your way and my way is what got us here. My way is not to do it according to some prescribed method. My way is to go out there and lie and cheat and con and connive and do it any, you know, cut every corner there is and, you know, con everybody out of their socks. That's my way. And my way is what got me here. And your way is what got you here. So the people who wrote this book wouldn't have taken the time, nor the effort, nor the energy to put numbers on the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous if we could do it any way we wanted to. And so I'm eternally grateful. And the more I think about it, the more grateful I become. And it's just a passing thought, but on the plane on the way up here today, I heard some idiot sitting in two rows back and talking about how drunk he was last night and how drunk he's going to get tonight, and when he gets to San Jose, he's going to get them all, and, you know. And I get to thinking, thank God that this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous happened in my time on this planet Earth, and it happened in your time on this planet Earth. So we have to be some kind of chosen people, because all the drunks in the world up to 1935 just died from alcoholism. They just died, and there wasn't a way to go. And then this thing happened in your time and my time on this planet Earth, and there was a way out that was given to you and given to me. And so I have to be grateful, or I would surely be dead today, because that's the way I drank. And so, because if you look at the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't mean to dwell on this, but if you look at the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, each one is intertwined with the other, and each one is written in the past tense. So it's humanly impossible to do step two unless you've done one. Can't do three unless you've done two. Impossible to do four unless you've done three. Cannot do five unless you've done four. Humanly impossible to do six unless you've done five. And so on, and so on, and so on, until you get to 12, where it says in the past tense again, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That means you've done 11. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And if that's easy for you, I want to talk to you after the meeting. And so if this has something to do with our thinking, then I believe it's very important that I share some of the kind of thinking that brought me to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, because like you, I didn't want to come here in the first place. And in all my travels in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never found anybody yet who said, oh no, I planned my whole life to get to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Haven't found one yet. Most of us stayed out there till the last damn minute, you know. Because I don't know about you, but especially the guys in this room, I was taught from the time I was this high that men don't give in to nothing. And if you're going to be a man, you stick in there and you tough it out. And you hang in there and you hang and you hang, and by God, you're going to beat it. And that's how you're going to be a man. And that's what I tried to do. And I hung in there, by God, till I couldn't anymore. And I came that close to dying, hanging in there. I don't know about you, but I get to thinking about the people I've met who are no longer with us, who died from alcoholism. And I always have to think about my buddy Pete. About this time of the year anyhow. Because about 18 years ago, maybe a little bit less, Pete and I were on a drunk. And I can't tell you to this day how long that drunk lasted. But I came to that morning in this flop house, and Pete didn't come to. He didn't make it. They say apparently during the night he swallowed his tongue in a convulsion and died. And he was a hell of a man. He was at that time, and I'm sure he still is. And I was certain in my mind that he is a better man than I am. And it used to bug me when I got sober why Pete had to go and I had to stay. And it got me to the point where it was just bugging me incessantly. And I talked to a guy who had been sober since Lincoln had the measles about Pete. And he put it to me this way. He said, "Bob, don't fuss. First of all, that's not your business. You're trying to take over God's business. And remember that, thank God that you and I don't decide who's going to go and who's going to stay." And then he said that you're probably supposed to be in San Jose, California, on the 24th of January, 17 years sober. And I'm eternally grateful for that. But I can't help once in a while get a little choked up when I think about Pete. And so, I have to tell you some of the kind of thinking that brought me here. You know, I think I was born in an average American family. And everything was normal, I think. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. We weren't pitifully poor. My father was a policeman. And he was 6'4", weighed 240 pounds, wore a uniform, carried a gun, scared the living bejesus out of you. And for the first 11 years of my life, I stuck away from him, and I played it hip, slick, and cool, and kept out of his way. Absolutely certain, if he ever hit me, he'd kill me. I mean, he was a big moose, and I was scared to death of him. And at the age of 11, the first miracle that ever happened in my life happened, strictly by accident. I didn't wake up at the age of 11 and say on a Saturday morning to my mother, "I'm going out and get drunk today." You know, most 11-year-olds don't happen that way. But I went over to my friend Peter's house, another Peter. I went down in Peter's basement to do the things that kids, boys do at 11 years old. Sawing wood and pounding nails, making sailboats to run down the gutter in the rainy season. And all that jazz. And then all of a sudden I spotted this empty barrel standing over in the corner that the adults had been drinking from about 2 weeks before at one of them neighborhood beer parties. You know how they are? All the moms and dads and everybody's out in the backyard, and they're all pouring these glasses around, and they're all drinking and smiling, and the women are giggling, and the guys are telling funny stories, and they're telling us kids that we can't have any, and it's no good for you, and you're too small. And right then and there, I made up my mind I'm going to get some of that stuff. Because I don't know about you, but it seemed to me to be synonymous with what adults do to have fun. And every time I saw a gathering of adults, they were all imbibing in some stuff, you know, and they were having a lot of fun and laughing. And so I thought it was all synonymous with what adults do to have fun. And I don't know about you, but at the age of 11, if there was one thing that I wish I could have that day, was to be 21 and be able to do all the things that adults do. But here's the time, and there's the barrel, and there are no adults around. So I went over there and put air in the barrel and pulled the spigot, and out come this juice. And Peter and I are standing down in the basement, just like the big people, saying dirty words to each other and all that stuff. Just like the big people. And then the miracle of alcohol happened. And it happened to me, and it didn't happen to Peter. Now, I know it didn't happen to Peter. Because once a year, I'm invited to speak in my hometown back in Wisconsin. And everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous in that town and all the little towns around are all there. And Peter's never there. He's still living in that town, raising a bunch of kids and going to work every day like them squares do. And he doesn't know anything about all that real living I was doing out there all them years. And going to jail and living in them cold cars and drinking that rot-gut wine. You and I refer to it as the high cost of low living. But by God, it happened to me, because all of a sudden, right here, and that's where alcoholism takes place, is right here. 95% of our alcoholism is right here. It has to do with our thinking. And all of a sudden, right here, I wasn't a little kid anymore. I wasn't a skinny little kid anymore. And next to my old man, the second most fearful thing in my life at the age of 11 was a thing that every guy in his room knows what I'm talking about, was the neighborhood bully. And I was scared to death of that sucker. I used to run around the corner and down the alley just to avoid him, afraid he'd beat the crap out of me. And all of a sudden, and we had to work fast too, we only had a half an hour before we started puking. But in that half-hour span, all of a sudden, that neighborhood bully shrunk about 3 feet, right here. And I was certain that morning that I could walk out of that basement, find that big bully, and beat the crap out of him. Something I wanted to do all my life. Now, I didn't run right out of that basement that morning, find that big bully, and beat the crap out of him, neither. Because my religion don't allow me to do that. I'm a devout coward, too. But I never forgot that feeling that happens to you and I, that all of a sudden, right here, I could be anything I wanted to be. And I loved the effect of alcohol from the word go, right out of the chute. And I don't want one person leaving here tonight and think at the age of 11, the next day I moved down to Skid Row. Because it don't happen like that, you know. It takes a little time and takes a little doing. At the age of 13, another traumatic thing happened to me. As I look back in retrospect, I developed my first bad attitude. Now, you and I, on the day we were born good. We were born in God's image, and we were born good. And then it's all downhill from there, you know. Because along the way, we as humans have one thing that animals don't have, I guess. We have this brain that sometimes is a very dangerous thing. And especially to you and I, we get to thinking. And I guess up until that day, I thought highly of my parents and I thought highly of everything in life. And then the old man called us three boys in the living room one night. And he said, I want to tell you guys something. And I thought, oh God, here comes the birds and the bees. He said, no, I want to tell you something else. He says, because I am what I am in this community, and you happen to be in the situation you're in, if I ever walk into the police station in the morning and see one of your names on a blotter from the night before for anything, anything at all, I want you to remember these four little words. Be prepared to die. And he meant it. And I knew he could do it. And right then and there, I started to hate his guts. Because he represented authority in my life. Because here's a guy telling me what I'm going to do, when I'm going to do it, and how I'm going to do it. And you know what? We got rooms full of people tonight, sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous across this entire country, who don't like us have people telling us what we're going to do, when we're going to do it, and how we're going to do it. We don't like authority. We especially don't like cops. And here I am living with one. and I was ready for this outfit a long time ago and didn't even know it. You and I are the kind of people, even in long periods of sobriety, who believe in the bottom of our hearts that all those signs out there that we have to live with, no left turn, no right turn, 35 miles an hour, 55 miles, that's for those other idiots. That isn't for us. And we usually have the tickets to prove it, too. We don't like authority. And so, about the age of 15, another traumatic thing happened to me. And I thought it was a big deal at the time, you know? And come to find out, it's no big deal. It happens to every human being. Every human being about 15, male, female, it doesn't make any difference. And it comes overnight. It goes kaboom. It's a case of the smarts. It comes overnight. It seems like one day we're an idiot and the next day we're a genius. In our humble opinion, of course. And I don't know what you were doing at the day that it happened to you. But up until the day it happened to me, I was doing everything that that moose told me I had to do. If he told me to run to the store, I ran to the store. If he told me to carry the trash, I carried the trash. If he told me to rake leaves, I raked leaves. If he told me to shovel snow, I shoveled snow. And then kaboom happened. And I came home from school that day, the next day, and it was a heavy, wet snow, and I know my job, and I know my responsibility in that household. My job is if 5 flakes of snow fall on that sidewalk, it's my job to take it off of there. Until kaboom. And if you don't believe that this takes place, go out there tonight, find a 15-year-old. Ask him a question on any subject in the world. Science, medicine, engineering, he'll tell you. Absolute geniuses, 15-year-olds. Smartest people in the world, in their humble opinion. And I was no different. And I came home from school that noon and knew what I had to do. But all of a sudden, I says, you know, what will the... And the logic still makes sense to me today. I said to myself, what will the neighbors say, a genius out there shoveling snow? So I said, screw it, I just won't do it no more. I mean, it's beneath my station in life. So I took the shovel and set it up against the house and walked in and let it snow. The hell with it, I won't do it no more. And I sat down and started to eat my lunch. And then the squad car pulled up in front. And I heard the car door slam. And then I heard the shovel going out there on the sidewalk. And I said to myself, I developed another bad attitude. I said to myself, and only to myself, it's about time he does something around here, you know. You know, did you ever have the feeling that the whole damn world's dependent on you for everything, you know? Like, you got to do it all? And that's the way I felt. And he came in the house all out of breath because he wasn't used to that manual labor. I was doing it all. And he took off that uniform cap and that Mackinac, that Sam Brown belt and that 45. And he laid it on the dining room table like he did every day. And came into the kitchen and sat down right across from me at the kitchen table. And I was waiting for that sucker. All he'd have to do is say one word and I'm going to let him have both barrels, you know. And he threw me a curve and he didn't say a word. And that's where, if you're alcoholic, like I'm alcoholic, we have another thing in common. Because we're the kind of people who couldn't let a situation like that go by without saying something. And I had finished my lunch and I had to go back to school and I had to go past him. And I can't explain it, but if it happened to you in any other situation, I just could not resist the temptation to say something. And I got just even with him and I looked him right in the eye and one of them pearls of wisdom come to the top. Must have surfaced just then. And looked him right in the eye and said the smartest thing I could think of. I said, it's a snow heavy today. He didn't say a word again. He just kind of turned in the chair and came all the way from right field with the flat of the hand and got a direct hit right here. And I took off in the air 20 feet into the dining room. And I want to tell you, I've never been hit before, since, hope I never am, like I was hit that day. But the point of this whole thing is, when I came to, I developed another bad attitude. I said to myself, and only to myself, nobody can hit me like that and get away with it. I'll get even with him, by God, if it kills me. And you want to know something? That's the kind of thinking that keeps most alcoholics drinking. You know what I'm talking about? Get out there and show them and fix them and get even with every damn one of them. And that's what kind of thinking kept most of us drinking. And thank God there's a way out of that dilemma, or I'd be out there tonight getting even with them. Thank God there's a way out. And it's in a process called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we have to commit those feelings about those people and all those SOBs and how we're going to get even with them. And we got to commit it to writing. Our own handwriting. And then we got to tell another human being about these god-awful thoughts we have about our fellow man and how we're going to plan his demise and all that crap. And thank God there's a way out. Or I would surely be out there tonight amongst them. Well, right out of high school, I'd been going with this gal, and we got married. It was a beautiful event. Crossed white shotguns, everything. We used to rationalize it by saying it happens in the best regulated families and all that jazz. And 12 days ago, it was 33 years ago, and I'm eternally grateful she stuck around. And I want to say a few words for the non-alcoholics in this room tonight and the members of Al-Anon. I believe you and I, as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, had better stop condemning the members of Al-Anon. And we better stop condemning the non-alcoholics in our lives. Because I don't know about you, but most of the alcoholics I know would not have gotten here without some non-alcoholic praying for us. Because left to my own devices, and I can only speak from my situation, but left to my own devices, I'm a tongue-chewing, pants-wetting, car-sleeping drunk. My best shot out there. And so I'm eternally grateful for the non-alcoholics in my life. And to the Al-Anon family program. And I hope in your area that your Al-Anon groups are like my wife's Al-Anon groups and they don't serve roast drunk there. Unfortunately, it's happening in a lot of Al-Anon meetings and they're starting to serve roast drunk in Al-Anon meetings and it is not the purpose of Al-Anon because they were really sick. I mean, we had to go through this whole thing drunk, and they had to do it sober. And so I'm eternally grateful for them. And we had two kids as a result of that marriage, and I want to take a minute to talk about that. Because I think it's important. But right about this time, I got to be the one thing that I had never planned to be in my life. I got to be a drunk cop, just like my old man. And time doesn't permit me to tell you what can happen to a drunk cop, except stir up some old resentments, and God knows you probably don't need any more. But sufficient to say, I believe if I had my druthers today, I would still be a cop. But my whole career, because I loved law enforcement and I loved everything about it, I loved all the excitement and the camaraderie and all the things that go on with being a cop. And I would have done anything short of murder to keep that job because I loved it. Only one other thing, stay away from one little drink of booze. And my whole career got down to one question. Do I have another drink of booze or did I save my job? And I had to take another drink. And in a drunken stupor, we were at a bunch of cops and our wives were at a party one night. And she says that I was at that, went to that party dead sober. And inside of 2 hours, I was a wild raving maniac one more time. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The dual personality of the alcoholic came out again. And she said, "Let's go." And I says, "What are you talking about, woman? We just got here." And she said, "Let's go." And we left. And she badmouthed me all the way home about my drinking. And I'm going to defend my right to drink, by God, if it kills me. And we got in the house and she wouldn't shut up. So I reached for the only thing I know would shut her up, a 38. And I said, "Woman, I've heard all I'm ever going to hear from you about my drinking. I'm going to blow your damn brains out." And she took off like a deer out the front door. 6 blocks down the street to the only place in God's green earth she knew she could get help, the sheriff's department that I work in. And I was right in direct pursuit, and I'd have got her too if she just slowed down. And she went running into the sheriff's department, and I was right on her tail. And then all of a sudden, that moment of clarity you talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous happened. I came out of that blackout and realized just where the heck I was. Grabbed a piece of paper from the sergeant, scribbled my resignation, knowing full well that they could not afford to lose the best man in that department. And they accepted it. Took away my badge, my gun, and my uniform. And I had to go out there and face that world bare naked. And that's too much for a normal person, much less a drunk like me. And so at the age of 31, I did the most adult, mature thing I could think of. I ran away from home. Out to California. Far away from that damn town as I could get. Only I forgot one thing. I had to bring me along. And that's the problem. Me. And that's your problem, you. Because I was sitting in a room all by myself with all of my enemies. If you understand that. Because I was my own worst enemy. And like I said, we had 2 kids as a result of that marriage, and I want to take a minute to talk about that because I believe it's important. It's in the book, and we better talk about it or we all get drunk at it. It has to do with alcoholism, the family disease. And this is a family disease. The whole family gets sick. And the whole family has to get well. And if you don't believe that alcoholism is a family disease, take 5 minutes out of your busy lives next week. Go visit your neighborhood junior high school at high noon. And go down in the lunchroom, stand in the back and watch the effects of alcoholism right before your eyes. Because those kids are sitting down at long tables like the ones they have in the back there. And they're all having a bowl of soup and a sandwich and a cup of milk. And they're all doing the same thing. They're talking. And they're all talking about the things that happened at their house last night. And the girls are talking about the things they did with their mom last night. And the boys are all talking about the things they did with their dad last night. And they're all talking about the things they did together as a family last night. And I don't care what junior high school you decide to go to. There's a kid sitting over there and one down here. And they got their head down in their soup, and they ain't saying nothing to nobody. Because you know what happened at their house last night? Like happened at my house and your house. About 3 a.m, their drunken mother or their drunken father got them all out of a sound sleep. And the screaming and the hollering and all the profanity that goes on in alcoholic houses started all over again. Calling their mother a damn whore and all that crap. And just so you know, I didn't get here by mistake. One of those times I came home at 3 a.m. and got them all out of a sound sleep, and the screaming and the hollering and all the profanity started all over again. And the youngest was a boy, 13 at the time, and I was pushing his mother around the kitchen. And he reached in the kitchen drawer and pulled out a butcher knife and said, "You lay one more hand on my mother and I'll run this through you." And for the first time in my adult life, I backed away from a punk-nosed 13-year-old kid. Not because he had a butcher knife, but I could see the hate in his eyes. Yeah, the hate that I'd put there and booze had put there. He wasn't born with it. And today, just before I got on the plane, that same kid is 32. And he calls me up just to say, "Hi, Dad. How you doing?" And that he loves me. And that's tough for me to take, coming from where I come from. It's hard for me to accept the love of those kids, because I damn near killed it. And then another miracle happened. 17 months ago, that same kid called me up to tell me for the first time in my adult life, I was a grandfather. And last night, that little girl, he trusts his father well enough to keep that little girl for a whole weekend. And that has to be a miracle for me, coming from where I come from, because they couldn't trust me with nothing. And every time I pick up that little girl and walk her around the house, and she calls me Bampa, and she kisses me on the cheek, I get to thinking about those nights out there in them cold cars and drinking that rot gut wine. And I get to thinking like this. Just think, a couple more drinks and I'd miss this whole deal. I don't know why you're here, but I came here to live, because I know all there is to know about dying. And thank God that there's a way out of this dilemma, and that I found a whole new way to live. Unbelievable. Beyond my furthest comprehension. And it's all happened as a direct or indirect result of my affiliation with you. And so I owe you my life. And I got to a place that they had provided for me, and they had provided for you. And they're all over this country. And they're called AA clubhouses. And some of them are good, and some of them are bad, and some of them are different. But I believe they have a purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. At least in the beginning. Because I got to a place because I had no place else left to go. And I got to one of those clubhouses. And every one of them I've ever been in across this country are all the same. Maybe the paint is different and the walls are different. And maybe everything else is different. But the main ingredient, the people, is all the same. And there was a couple old-timers sitting there playing cribbage. And one poked the other one and says, we better do something with him or he's going to start jackknifing around the room here. You know, I wasn't nervous, just quick, you know. And they applied the only therapy they knew at the time. They gave me a bucket of paint and a paintbrush, figuring that I could paint faster than anybody else in the place. And I painted that damn clubhouse. And I can't tell you to this day how long it took to paint that clubhouse. But I'll never forget the day I finished it. It was a Saturday morning, a beautiful Saturday morning like today. And I finished painting that clubhouse. And then I put the buckets away and the brushes and cleaned everything up just perfect, you know, we're perfectionists. And then I found out the truth, that one of them old-timers had been a painter all his life. And that old thinking came back that fast. Why me, God? Why wasn't he up there painting? And I'll get even with every one of them suckers. I'll get drunk at every damn one of these phonies. And I headed out the back door of that clubhouse, bound and determined to quit Alcoholics Anonymous and get drunk at every damn one of you. And then God, as I understand God, performed another miracle. And he did it fast. He had to do it fast. I was gone. Because he moved a guy from Riverside, California to Glendale, California that second. Because I reached for the push bar on the door and the door opened up ahead of me. And there's this guy standing on the landing. He had a smile from ear to ear. And he says, hi! And I said, shut it! He says, why do you say that to me? I don't even know you. I said, shove it anyhow. He said, come here, I want to talk to you. And he took me by the arm and took me back in the meeting hall, and he set me down, and I told him about them gray-haired goats, and they made me paint that club, and I'm going to get drunk at every damn one of them. And today he's my sponsor. So be damn careful what you pray for, you're liable to get it. And he said, if I'm going to be your sponsor, one thing's going to happen to you, buddy. You're going to go to meetings. You're going to go to meetings, by God, when you don't want to go to meetings. And he meant it. He walked like he talked, thank God. And he was tough. And he told me I had to do these things. And I had to do them in order. And he said, between page 1 and 164 of this book is your entire life. What will you do to save your life? And I said, I'll do anything. Anything. And he said, then you will have to do this thing, and you will have to study this book. It is not a novel. Thank God. And they say at that time there were 700 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous each week in the Los Angeles area. And I think we made them all. It was meetings every night. And newcomers, it's going to happen to you because it's happened to every one of us. So don't make no big deal about that. And you're going to say it to your wife or your husband or your buddy or your girlfriend, meetings every night. Tonight I'm not going. And that night he came by early. Put me in the car and started down the freeway. I says, where are we going tonight? He says, we're going to the hole in the ground. I thought, oh my God, they're going to bury me now. And for those of you who don't know about the hole in the ground, it's underneath the Ebel Club in Huntington Park, California. It was started by a guy by the name of Tex Adams, who'd been sober since Lincoln had the measles. And thank God for people like Tex who started places like that for drunks like me. And he told me I had to study this book, and I thought, how can a bunch of words in a book keep a smart drunk like me sober? You know, it doesn't make sense. But he told me I had to do it, so I did it. And sure as heck, I read the book, and it was just a bunch of words. Except one thing. It jumped right off the page. It says, if you can't be honest with yourself, try at least to be honest with your sponsor. And I knew that night I had to tell him how I felt about this outfit, because I didn't like it. And we got out of the car and started down to, across the street and down the steps into the Evo Club in Huntington Park, California. And I tapped him on the shoulder and says, Joe, I got to ask you something. And he turned around and he says, yeah, now what? You know, he wasn't very friendly anyhow. And then I asked him that world-famous question that all newcomers eventually ask their sponsor. How long do I have to go to these goddamn meetings? And this wise old man with the X-ray vision, who could see right through all that phony baloney crap, I guess he had had all the stupid questions he could take out of me, and he backed me into the corner of that outside the meeting hall. And when he got me in the corner where I couldn't get away, he started to get violent. And he took his index finger and started to hit me in the chest like this. And then he started to scream. And he said the most profound thing he's ever said to me in 17 years. He said, you idiot! You have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. Then you don't have to go to meetings anymore! Didn't make much sense then, but it sure does now. But that night, because he screamed at me and hit me in the chest, I said, I'm going to fix his clock. I might have to be in the meeting, but I'm not going to listen. Sounds familiar, huh? So I sat in the meeting staring around the room, because I'm not going to listen to those jerks. And so I started counting light bulbs, just for something to do. And then I ran out of light bulbs. Then I started winking at girls. And then I ran out of girls. And then all of a sudden I realized there's 10 minutes left in the meeting, and Jesus, I need a ride home. And he's got the keys, and I know he won't give them to me. And they had a bulletin board right near the door. And they had all them flyers, you know, that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous about the roundups and the conventions and the bingos and the dances and, you know, special meetings and all that crap. So I read through all of those because I'm not going to listen to those jerks. And none of it made any sense, and it's all a bunch of crap, and I'm going to go crazy. And you know, for me and you to go crazy is to drink again. And Jesus, I believe that God in his infinite wisdom works through people. And I'm certain that that day, or just before that meeting, some drunk was in that meeting, in that meeting hall, and with a little piece of paper and a pencil, he scribbled a little poem on a piece of paper this big. With pencil, he scribbled a little poem about drunks, and it was in amongst all those papers. And I was going through there, and it was just going crazy. And then all of a sudden, I spotted this little piece of paper, and some drunk had written a little poem about drunks. And Jesus, I read it, and it made sense. And when nobody was looking, I stole it. put it in my pocket and took it along home. And on the days when I was absolutely certain that I just can't do this thing, and it might be all right for you guys, but I can't make it. And yet I didn't want to go out there and die. And I'd get it out of my billfold and I'd read it, and it saved my can a million times. And it's time to go, and I want to thank the committee for asking me. But I believe it's important that I share this little poem with you because it's part of my sobriety, and I owe my life to it. It's a little poem entitled, Which Place? I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind. Started down that lonesome trail, some of my friends to find. Came to a signboard on the trail, directions it did tell. Keep right to go to heaven, turn left to go to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless, boozing rake, and knew that at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. So I started on the rocky path that leads to Satan's place, and shook within not knowing just what I'd have to face. Old Satan met me at the gate, "What's your name, my friend?" I said, "I'm just old Sober Sam that's come to a sad end." He glanced through some files, "You made a mistake, I fear. You're listed as an alcoholic. We don't want you here." I said, "I'm looking for my friends." And a smile stole over his face. "If your friends are alcoholics, they're in the other place." So I went back the other way till the crossroads I did see. Turned right to heaven, as happy as could be. St. Peter smiled and said, "Come in, for you I have a berth. You're an alcoholic. You've been through hell on earth." I saw old Doug. And old Pete too. Bill C. and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled, because I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, all take warning. Learn something from my trip. You got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell them you're going to heaven and he can go to hell. Thank you.